There is an African proverb which goes like this. The lion does not turn back in fear when it hears the dogs barking. Okay? I want to talk about evil and suffering this morning. We've sung a little bit about it as we've done this morning, but to deal with evil, to deal with suffering is a fundamental issue in terms of having to make sense of what life is like and what it's about. When we experience it, and there's not one of us in this room who hasn't had to face heartache of many descriptions, and currently many of you are. But I'm hoping that this comes into focus as we talk about it. Annie Dillard wrote, she's written about 15 books, but she wrote in 1977 a book called Holy the Firm. And she tackled some of this issue. And she said that the most pressing question that we face in our society, not just in the church, but in our society, the most profound theological question is, what the heck is going on here anyway? And the point is that if we can't answer that question for ourselves, it makes it very difficult for us to have a sense of not being blown around by all the bad things that happen and then good things, and it's just hard to put it in context. And I think when we experience evil, it comes, you know, when you have a toothache. Okay, we've all had a toothache. But when you've got this blinding toothache, you don't really much care that your elbow is working well, do you? Evil and suffering, when it happens to us, heartache and pain, it sort of absorbs and focuses everything on that particular thing. And that's why it feels so urgent. But when we come to Revelation, and when we come to dealing with the issue of sin and heartache and suffering and evil and all that stuff, it's not the first question. Even though it is a question that crowds in on us for some sort of answer. So what's happened in Revelation is that we've had a look, first of all, in chapter 1, we looked at how God shows us who his word is. And then we have this vision of the magnificent conquering Christ. Then in chapter 4 and 5, as we saw over the last couple of weeks, there is this incredible vision of heaven opened and the whole host of heaven worshiping, that we are participant in a worshiping community. And sandwiched in between those two issues or realities, if you like, is the thing that connects them, which is the church in chapters 2 and 3. The dusty, dirty, down-to-earth reality of life as it is for us, with the good and the bad. So it starts off with Christ. It goes into the reality of the church, and then John's attention is focused on this door that's open in heaven and what he sees. And then we come to chapter 6 and 7. And the reason this is important, the reason that this is critical, is if we don't understand what reality looks like. I was just standing there while we were worshiping and looking at the floor and thinking, it looks just like parquet flooring, doesn't it? And it actually is. Except that there is another reality, an even more mysterious, profound reality, is that there are atoms and molecules and electrons, and they all in enormous energy bouncing around. There is a reality that is not just visible instantly to the naked eye. There is a deeper reality in life that goes beyond what you see and what you experience as a physical reality. There's something larger at stake. And if we don't peg out the boundaries of what that reality is, then when stuff happens to us, we get knocked this way and that way, and we have no sense of where we are and who we are. That's why dealing with this subject is important, and why John, as he frames it here, has a lot to say with us. And the first thing to notice before we read is this happens in the context of worship. And you know what we had last week and the week before, that there was this thing with John weeping because no one could open the scroll, and Jesus comes and the Lamb unseals the scroll and immediately the weeping ceases. And really what's going on is we are positioned in a place where we are ready to hear how worship and history interact with each other. What your daily life looks like and what the huge reality that we have been grafted into as followers of Jesus, what that looks like. How do they intersect? How do we understand it? How do we make sense of what's going on? Just a hint here, and I probably will say it again later, but the Bible makes no effort to explain evil. All it does is give it a context. So, let's read. And I'm going to read from the Message. And I'm going to read the whole of chapter 6. And I'm going to read verse 1 and verse 9 and 10 from chapter 7. So, here we go. I watched while the Lamb ripped off the first of the seven seals. I heard one of the animals roar, "Come out!" I was going to shout, but I think make some of you jump. I looked, I saw a white horse. Its rider carried a bow and was given a victory garland. He rode off victorious, conquering left and right. When the Lamb ripped off the second seal, I heard the second animal cry, "Come out!" Another horse appeared, this one red. Its rider was off to take peace from the earth, setting people at each other's throats, killing one another. He was given a huge sword. When he ripped off the third seal, I heard a third animal cry, "Come out!" I looked, a black horse this time. Its rider carried a set of scales in his hand. I heard a message. It seemed to issue from the four animals. A quart of wheat for a day's wages, or three quarts of barley, but all the oil and wine you want. When he ripped off the fourth seal, I heard the fourth animal cry, "Come out!" I looked. A colorless horse, sickly, pale. Its rider was death, and hell was close on its heels. They were given power to destroy a fourth of the earth by famine, war, disease, and wild beasts. When he ripped off the fifth seal, I saw the souls of those killed because they had held firm in the witness to the word of God. They were gathered under the altar and cried out in loud prayers, "How long, strong God, holy and true, how long before you step in and avenge our murders?" Then each martyr was given a white robe and told to sit back and wait until the full number of martyrs was filled from among their servant companions and friends in the faith. I watched while he ripped off the sixth seal. A bone-jarring earthquake, sun turned black as ink, moon all bloody, stars falling out of the sky like figs shaken from a tree in a high wind, sky snapped shut like a book, islands and mountains sliding this way and that, and then pandemonium. Everyone and his dog running for cover. Kings, princes, generals, rich and strong, along with every commoner, slave or free. They hid in mountain caves and rocky dens, calling out to mountains and rocks, "Refuge, hide us from the one seated on the throne and the wrath of the Lamb. The great day of their wrath has come. Who can stand it?" Big question. Immediately, I saw four angels standing at the four corners of earth, standing steady with a firm grip on the four winds, so no wind could blow on earth or sea, not even the rustle of a tree. I saw another angel rising from where the sun rose, carrying the seal of the living God. Yeah, let's just leave it at that for the moment. Each seal that is broken reveals another aspect of how God deals with the reality that we face. And the whole of history, and we're talking now not only from the sense of the beginning of time all the way through till the end of time, we're talking about your history and my history. Our history is ordered by the way God sees it, not by what we are told. So there are four unsealings. What were the four? First ones were horses. The horse is a symbol of war. And I want to just say that conflict and war is a basic substrate of life as it is. We are at war. And I don't want to go into a great deal of detail about this now, but we fight and wrestle and war, not against flesh and blood, Paul tells the Ephesian church. You know that's that particular verse. Paul writes to the Romans and he said, the things I want to do, I don't want to do. There's this inner conflict and struggle, and we know that as well in terms of our own lives, where we want to do stuff and we don't do it, and we end up doing the stuff we don't want to do. And you just have to listen for half an ear to how many people struggle with what they eat, to just know that it's a struggle everybody has at different levels of the different issues. We are at war with ourselves half the time, because there is a greater reality that we are living into. So the first thing that we need to make a note of is that this is what the human condition looks like. And then in verse 2, chapter 6, verse 2, come out, this huge voice, this loud shout. And what comes? He looks and sees this huge white horse. Now, I'm not going to go into all the symbolisms and all that stuff, because we've said all along that's not the primary purpose of the way we're going through Revelation. We understand that Revelation is a letter that Paul sent to John wrote as he saw things. He sent to the seven churches that he was pastor of. He's being pastoral. And the white horse is literally Christ in history, conquering and victorious. And you can go and look in chapter 21 and other places in the scriptures. This is Christ. And so really what's happening is when the seal is broken, and if you remember back to what we said about the scroll is the revelation of God's purpose for history, for life, for the universe, if you like. And no one can open it. No one can make sense of it, except that the Lamb, who is the Lion, makes sense of it. And so he begins to break open these seals, things that are hidden. He breaks open them. And the first thing that we are confronted with is that when it comes to warfare, the dominant reality, and we need to really hear this, the dominant reality is that Christ is conquering and has conquered. Done and dusted. If we haven't got that as a basic foundational issue for ourselves, then we will be battered. We will be. It has to be something that is so seeped into who we are as individuals, as in terms of our faith, that Christ rides the white horse, conquered, conquering and continually conquering. What did I say? Having conquered and conquering. Complete, past, present and future. So, we'll come to this in a second, but it's across every aspect of our lives. Christ is victorious. It's done. When he hung on the cross and he said, "It is finished," he meant it. And he's endorsed in what he did by the resurrection from the dead, that his Father raised him from the dead. We now have life. So we will look at this in another context at another time, but he doesn't conquer like everyone else conquers. He doesn't use the way of conquering. We haven't got really time to go into this, but he conquers in a different way, not with control, coercion, overwhelming violence. He conquers with primarily love and humility and gentleness and serving and ultimately dying. I promise it makes sense in a minute. Then we get the three other horses. And when these things are called out, these horses are called out. So there is a red horse and then a black horse and then a pale horse that looks sickly as if it's dying. The word is what we get our word for chloroform. And it's that sort of sickly, greeny, yellowy tinge that looks like you can almost see through it. A vision of Jesus is not sufficient unless we can account for how life actually is. Because unless we can say, this is what makes sense of everything that happens in our lives, unless we can say, here's what's going on, then that's very sweet and very nice, but it seems to belong over there. So here are the forces. The red horse is the horse of war. And war is a social evil. And so, if you like, war attacks the goodness of community. And it's a sin against society as God has constructed it. The black horse is ecological evil, in the sense of there is lack and want. And the pale horse is sickness and disease, death. Now, each of these things, each of these horses, war and famine and death and disease, are kind of out there. They are over there. But when we look at them, they come to us in all kinds of disguises. We have to deal with them, not over there, not only in terms of how they impact my life and are impinging on my well-being, but we have to deal with all of these things in us. None of this stuff is like only over there. The struggle against these things is going on and raging within us, because we have succumbed to the fallenness of the world that we live in. We are part of the disease of the world, and we're in the process of being redeemed. Yes, we are, but we are continuing being saved. So, war is dressed up as competition. We live in a very competitive world. We compete for absolutely everything. And we are trained from this big that if you want what you want, you've got to make sure that you can get what you get. And it doesn't take long before it becomes a thing where everything else other than yourself is objectified. It and they, it's not human any longer, because they are seen as adversaries. We are competing for what is there. We are competing for business. We are competing for food. We are competing. If you listen to the language that comes through your television and through your advertising, it's all about competition. And we ought to have it because we deserve it. And we have got to a stage where in our society, in our world, especially in the Western world, we are so self-absorbed. And we're in conflict with everybody else, everything else. It's who dares wins, and it's about winning. And it's epitomized in some of our political things that are going on in America and Western Europe and in various different places, Russia, China. Everyone wants to win. And so they'll use cyber warfare or economic pressures or whatever. Now, that's a global thing. But it's happening at work. It's happening where people are saying, I will get ahead, and there's all kinds of warfare going on in relationships at work. And it's happening at home, and it's happening wherever we go, because this is fundamental to what a broken life looks like. You can read James 4. I won't read it now, but basically, if we look carefully, this is something that we have to address. It's something we have to face. Not over there. Violence takes place in here. And it may just be words, just words. It may be physical, but we live in a world that is at war. And we are part of it. The second thing is the whole thing of famine. And we've seen pictures of Yemen and the ghastly things that are going on in so many war zones around the world, where people just have incredible lack of the basic stuff. And yet you speak to anybody who's in agriculture and they'll tell you there is plenty of food to go around. But it's used strategically. It's a weapon. And the imagery that's with the black horse is the thing of, it costs so much money for wheat, but oil and wine are in great supply. What the necessities cost a fortune, but there's plenty for luxury. And nobody in this room or in any society is untainted by this, because it's around the issue of greed. I deserve this because I've worked hard. My standard of living ought to be much higher than it is. I wish, I long for a better house, a better car, going out more often, nicer clothes. And we are all tarred with that brush. We have been corrupted by our greed. And when it comes to the evil of famine, it's a famine in our souls that we're dealing with. You and I have to grapple with what it means with everything that we do. What we eat, what we consume, what we buy, how we live. If we're going to be people of integrity. And none of us measure up. And then the fourth horse, which is the fourth seal, is that marvelous horse that we see all over the place. Sickness, disease, and death. Great stuff. One of the visible ways in which Jesus dealt with this issue is that wherever he went, there's so many verses in the Gospels that say, and he went here and he healed all of them, and he healed all their diseases. And he was manifestly saying that this is a thing that I need to deal with. Now, I'm not going to say a huge amount about that, but these three horses are fundamentally the stuff that we have to struggle with. And I'm saying it again and again this morning because I want us to understand it's not out there. It's in here. It's in here. So these four horsemen are brought out by this loud shout, "Come out!" And the reason we need to do this is that we need to see their true colors. How many people think that I'm nice? You must all put up your hands at this point, okay? But the truth is that I'm not. Yes, you would have known. I'll see you afterwards. The truth is that we are conditioned to hide and duck and dive And we have, if you go in and read the psychology, there are all kinds of mechanisms whereby we deflect and defer and make all kinds of things to keep at bay that we don't look at ourselves, because what we find when we look at ourselves is not nice. If you're honest, the emotions that come up, the thoughts that pop into your head, the things that you find yourself doing when you're under pressure, when you've got no money. It's about us. There are two other seals that are broken. End of chapter 6. Talks about persecution and people being killed for their faith. And then at the end of chapter 6 and into, it leaks into chapter 7, natural disasters. I think it's incredibly descriptive, the way that the message puts it. Basically, cataclysmic events where people, the just and the unjust, are caught in the sideswipe. And the first thing that cropped into my head when that happened was things like the tsunami that happened some years back, and those kind of things that are going on as the world is in upheaval, because the whole of creation is groaning under the oppression of this stuff. If we do not pay attention to this, out there and in here, we will not grow up. We will not mature. We will not come into the fullness that God has for us. If you keep papering over the cracks, if you keep bluffing yourself that there is nothing wrong, you cannot grow up. And John writes this, and he sends this to the churches in Western Turkey, Asia Minor, all the seven churches that are mentioned in chapters 2 and 3. And he wants them to understand, if you don't face the stuff that you have to face about yourself and about your society, and if you don't stand up and do something about it, then you do not understand what it means to be a follower of Jesus. You see, when we talk about becoming a Christian, and it's almost, and I've said this many times before, we want people to be saved so that they can go to heaven. Tick. But it's way more than that. It's way more than that. Because he wants us to be whole, to be complete, to be mature, to grow up. And to grow up is to face what's there and live in accordance with his values, the way the kingdom works. And when we do that, we're going to find ourselves confronting the deep stuff that bubbles up out of us and confronting the stuff that is sort of rampant in our society. It is tricky. I duck and dive with the best of them. You just have to ask Gail. We have things that happen to us and we react. And I want to invite you to take just one day and see, how do I react? What emotions spring up when things happen? What thoughts bubble up into my head? What do I do when people behave badly or I bump into something? Because essentially, what's inside bumps out. And Jesus said, it's not what goes into a man that defiles him, it's what comes out of him. And he's talking about the words we speak. But essentially, it's the thoughts, it's the feelings, it's everything that happens when we interact with life. What is there? And you see, Jesus, when he walked the earth, he came to live amongst us, to be like us. And when he comes into this world, he confronts, the first thing that happens as he comes into a time of the fullness of who he is that he gets baptized. And the heavens open, and his dad says to him, before he starts doing anything public, his dad says, this is my son. I love him. I'm pleased with him. He's brilliant. And then the Spirit of God drives him into the wilderness, into the desert. And he is confronted with demonic stuff, temptations, all kinds of things come at him, and he deals with it. And then all the way from there, he's dealing with sickness, he's dealing with entrenched power, he's dealing with all kinds of issues of the day, and he dies. But all the stuff we've spoken about this morning, he faces it, and he looks at it, and then he absorbs it all. He takes it all on himself. And he says, it's done. It's done. The lion does not turn back in fear when it hears the dogs barking, because he knows who he is. One swipe of the paw and that dog is history. We look at these things with such a sense of trepidation and fear. And what if people knew that I was actually X or Y or Z? The funny thing is, the more you try to hide things, pretty much the more obvious it becomes to others. It's true. And Jesus is the template for the way that we are to behave. We face the stuff that comes at us. Now, I personally haven't had any confrontation that I'm aware of with someone who's being trafficked. But if you are, you have to deal with it. If you find someone says something and there's a trigger word and there's this incredible anger that pops up in you, then you've got to look at it and say, what is this? Where does this come from? How do I deal with it? What are you going to do? Help me, God. Because the death and resurrection of Jesus is the way that we understand that it has a limit on it. So I'm running ahead of myself because I get very excited about this. You will need to be courageous in this. And God will not bring you to a place to deal with more stuff than you can actually deal with. There's no temptation taken you but such as is common to man. And God will also, with the temptation or testing, make a way of escape that you may be able to bear it. Paul writes to the Corinthian church. This is not something that you can't do. It's something that we don't and won't do because we are scared. Because we don't understand what's happened. So, at the end of chapter 6, it says, this desperate cry, it says, who can stand? When you start looking at society, when you start looking at yourself, when you start listening to me preaching like this, you think, oh my word, evil and suffering and death and destruction, famine, greed, all the stuff, I'm overwhelmed by everything. Who can deal with this? And if you go and read, and I'm not going to read it because we're running out of time rapidly, but if you go and read in chapter 7 again, there's two types of people. The angels stand and they hold things so that nothing can happen. The winds don't even blow, not even the rustle of a leaf on a tree. And the picture is that God has got the four corners of the earth. God has got stuff covered. And then there's the surprising thing, and we won't go into the 144,000, but essentially just understand that the 144,000 isn't an exact number of people who are going to get into heaven. It's 12 times 12 times 1,000. It's the 12 tribes and the 12 apostles, and multiplied is an image of the whole of those who follow the Messiah, those who are faithful. And it says, they are the ones who stand. And the reason that they stand is that we, you see, there's been an unsealing. Haven't we been talking about that? The first seal is broken, the second, the third, fourth, fifth. The sixth seal is broken. Do you notice that the seventh hasn't come yet? It's the white horse, the red horse, the black horse, the pale horse. It's the martyred, persecuted Christians. It's the what? Natural disasters. But where's the seventh seal? In between, what is happening is that the Christians are the one who stand. And in between the sixth and the seventh unsealing, there is a sealing. Not a sealing, but they are sealed. And this is amazing what Brenda shared this morning, because in a sense, if you go and read Ephesians 1 verse 13, and I think it's verse 20, or is it 4 verse 20? It's 4 verse 20. We are sealed with the Holy Spirit of God. In other words, God has come and he's put his mark on us. We are marked. We are marked men and women. Later on, we'll get to the mark of the beast. And so many Christians have got all twisted about the whole thing of that. What's more important is the mark of the Christian. We are signed and sealed with the Holy Spirit. It's the Christians who stand in all these moments. Why? Because we understand the context. Do you know, I've said this many times before, I do not believe in original sin. There's no such thing. I believe in original good. Because when God created the earth, it was, he looked at it and he said, this is good, this is good, this is good, this is very good. And then it was corrupted. And he'll deal with it, and he is dealing with it, and he did deal with it at the cross and the resurrection. What is Jesus talked of in the first chapter of Revelation? He's known as the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning, the end. He's there at the beginning of creation, and we sang again that he will be coming at the end of creation. He frames the entire world. So here's the thing about evil. It's limited. It has an expiry date. And the reason we can be strong, the reason that we are able to stand is that we are sealed by the Spirit of God. We know who we are. They may kill us. They may torture us. That's awful. I may be inflicted with sickness. I may have all kinds of things happen to me. But I know who I believed and am persuaded that he is able to keep me until that day. Don't ask me where that's from. I can't remember. It just popped into my head. Because we understand, you see, we look back on the Israelites in Egypt and we think, oh, they were delivered. They had this. They went into the promised land. Wasn't it wonderful? But they had 400 years of grappling with the tyranny of Pharaoh. We have this now not yet thing. Yes, Jesus has won the victory. We know that it's all dealt with. But we are working it out daily, and we are making it real in our own lives. So we struggle with our impatience. We grapple with our violent tendencies, our selfishness, our greed, all these things. And as we open ourselves and remember that we stand because we are sealed, not because of any great worth of our own, we are able to put a frame around evil. It has an expiry date. It has a beginning and it has an end. And yes, we're in this melting pot at the moment, but the reality of life is that this is not the reality that matters. Your disease, all the stuff that we've spoken of, I'm going to name them all again, but all the stuff we grapple with now is not the ultimate reality anymore. Then this tile on the floor is the only thing that is there. There is a deeper, more profound, more real reality than all the stuff you see in the newspapers and on TV. And unless you get that, when bad things happen, and they will and they do, and we want to say, oh, where's God? I've heard that I don't know how many times in my life. He's exactly where he always has been, in control, on the white horse, conquering and conqueror and conquering. And he is using us to stand. And we are the light of the world now. And we are the ones who take his life into everywhere we go, so that we infect the corrupt world of our workplace, our family life, all the places we go to. We infect it with life and love and joy and peace and patience and kindness and gentleness and long-suffering and self-control, which I lost completely this morning because it's now 12 o'clock. Oh, I could say so much more because this is such a vital thing that we understand. So let me finish with Paul's words. Try and guess where this is from. You can sort of see it's in the New Testament. This is the message. So what do you think? With God on our side like this, how can we lose? If God didn't hesitate to put everything on the line for us, embracing our condition and exposing himself to the worst by sending his own son, is there anything else he wouldn't gladly and freely do for us? And who would dare tangle with God by messing with one of God's chosen? Who would dare even point a finger? The one who died for us, who was raised to life for us, is in the presence of God at this very moment, sticking up for us. Do you think anyone is going to be able to drive a wedge between us and Christ's love for us? There is no way. Not trouble, not hard times, not hatred, not hunger, not homelessness, not bullying threats, not backstabbing, and you can make a long list as much as you like. None of this phases us. Because Jesus loves us. I'm absolutely convinced that nothing, nothing, living or dead, angelic or demonic, today or tomorrow, high or low, thinkable or unthinkable, absolutely nothing can get between us and God's love because of the way that Jesus, our Master, has embraced us. It's Romans 8. I don't care to have an answer. I have, I think, a fairly good logical answer about evil. But it doesn't make any difference because you're not going to win people with a philosophical answer about how evil started. What people want to know is how do you deal with it? And Revelation 5 and 6 put a context on it and give us a reality as believers that allows us to live in freedom and with joy and with authority no matter what happens. So just remember, the lion does not turn back in fear because he hears the dogs barking. We know who we are, what our inheritance is. We are sealed with the Holy Spirit. The power, the presence of God. Let's stand.